now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day, another great week in this greatest nation on God's green earth. It is great news, is it, that there may be some of the hostages who are coming back home. Not all of them, which is outrageous, but there is news that Hamas says it has accepted a ceasefire deal proposed by Egypt and Qatar, which seeks to halt the seven-month war with Israel in Gaza. The Israelis have not agreed to this yet. We will see if they do. It seems to me that with the information that we have about the deal, it is unlikely that the Israelis will agree, because there's still 132 hostages held captive. And that's the Israeli figure. And that includes, of course, people who have been killed already or have died from maltreatment by Hamas. They began with 250 hostages. They negotiated the release of other bits of hostages. We will see if Israel agrees to put off its last military operation, the operation to clean out terror tunnels and four terror battalions that are sheltered in Rafah. That's in the southernmost part of the Gaza Strip. Probably there will be news on this before the end of the show, and I'm eager to bring that to you as soon as that news breaks. Hamas says it accepted a ceasefire deal proposed by Egypt and Qatar. In a statement today, Hamas said the head of its political bureau, Ismail Haniyeh, told the Qatari prime minister and the Egyptian intelligence minister that the militant group had accepted their proposal. The Israeli government is now reviewing the Hamas response, CNN has learned. The Israeli prime minister's office has declined to comment at this stage. The reason I am skeptical about Israeli acceptance on this is that it involves not a complete release of the hostages, but a three-stage process of releasing hostages that covers 6 weeks. What is the point of that? It is to allow Hamas to rebuild militarily and to reestablish themselves in a more defensible position in their terror tunnels in Rafah. And it is unclear whether Hamas has agreed to the most recent ceasefire proposal as outlined last week or a revised version of it. The Jerusalem Post seems to think it is a revised version of the deal. The most recent framework, which Israel helped to craft but has not fully agreed to, calls for the release of between 20 and 33 hostages over several weeks in exchange for a temporary ceasefire and the release of Palestinian prisoners. This entire thing about the release of Palestinian prisoners, these are not people who are taken at random from their homes. These are not people who were kidnapped in the midst of a military operation. These are people who were arrested for terrorist crimes, including violence, assault, and murder. And they're people who have had trials, have had representation. Not everyone who is accused of terrorist crimes gets convicted of those crimes. But the idea of the misrepresentation, this goes back to Gilad Shalit, who was a famous Israeli, I believe he was a corporal, who was kidnapped in the midst of a confrontation with Hamas. This is years ago. And they ended up trading him alive after holding him for more than a year. He was traded for over 1,000 Palestinian terror prisoners. The setting up that example is precisely why the main goal of the Palestinians was not just to murder as many Jews as they possibly could, but to take as many hostages as they could to use to try to empty out the prisons of violent terrorists. The most recent framework says the release of 20 to 33 hostages, which is means that there would be about 100 hostages left, including the hostages that Hamas is least willing to release, which are Israeli soldiers. It's unclear how many there are, but there's more than 20 who were taken prisoner by Hamas, some of them grievously wounded, by the way. After the initial exchange, according to that framework, this is what is reported in the Jerusalem Post now. After the initial exchange, according to that framework, there would follow what sources describe as the restoration of sustainable calm, during which the remaining hostages, captive Israeli soldiers, and the bodies of hostages would be exchanged for more Palestinian prisoners. A diplomatic source familiar with the talks told CNN that after a day-long meeting in Doha, Qatar's capital, between CIA Director William Burns and the Qatari Prime Minister Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani, mediators convinced Hamas to accept this three-part deal. There's also word from NBC. They are saying that the proposal that Hamas said it agreed to is a three-phased hostage release that would play out over 6 weeks and would include a complete halt in military operations, an Arab official familiar with the deal said. The families of hostages in Gaza said Hamas's announcement that it is willing to accept a proposal must pave the way for the return of the 132 hostages still held captive. That, according to the Hostages and Missing Families Forum. They just had another huge demonstration in Israel on behalf of the families of the remaining hostages, who, of course, want the government to do everything it possibly can to get them home. Meanwhile, the foreign minister of Iran says that a Hamas senior leader told him the ball is now in Israel's court. This is Iran wanting to get some credit because their client terrorists at Hamas may have accepted at least some idea of a peace fire. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahanian said he held a telephone call with Ismail Haniyeh, who's the head of Hamas's political ring, today, after the group accepted a ceasefire deal proposed by Egypt and Qatar. Now the ball is in the opposite court, Haniyeh said during the call. The minister wrote on X, "We are honest in our intentions." Haniyeh had said, according to the minister, that Iran has been a supporter of Hamas and several other organizations across the region. John Kirby, the White House press spokesman for security matters, Admiral Kirby just gave a press conference. We'll play you some highlights of that coming up. We're also going to be speaking to Rich Lowry, the editor of National Review, about the Trump choice for vice president. Two of the leading contenders have both made news. Tim Scott, well, because of his answering a question about whether he would accept the results of the election even if Trump lost. And then more about shooting a 14-month-old dog, this involving another vice presidential front runner, Kristi Noem, the governor of South Dakota. We'll get to that with Rich Lowry coming up. We also have Michael Rubin from American Enterprise Institute on the ceasefire, what it means, all coming up on The Medved Show.
Michael Medved. We'll be right back.
And on the Michael Medved Show, just minutes before the show, John Kirby, Admiral John Kirby, who is the security spokesman for the White House, gave a press conference where he took every kind of question about this potential ceasefire. It is not an official ceasefire yet. Israel hasn't agreed to it. And my personal guess, not based on any inside information, but based on what I know about Israel and about the national mood and about the leadership of the country, is that if the ceasefire is of the nature suggested, which would mean basically an end to the war with Hamas maintaining its military ability to strike Israel again, I'm not at all sure that there will be Israeli agreement to the ceasefire. Already there have been comments by foreign press spokespeople in France and in Britain and elsewhere, plus the comments by Admiral Kirby this morning. There were all those comments basically pressing Israel to accept this potential ceasefire as suggested. We'll see. This is what Admiral Kirby had to say just moments ago in the White House.
It's not like we sit down pie in the sky and say, hey, today's a good day, let's negotiate with terrorists. You got to negotiate with who you got to negotiate to get people back with their families. So, frankly, if there's a better idea to get those hostages home with their families, I think we'd love to hear them. I just don't think there's another way to do it. There's no other way to do it, quite frankly. You got to negotiate through Qatar with Hamas to get those folks back with their families. I mean, that's the hard work of diplomacy. Sometimes it means you got to sit across the table from some really bad folks that you'd rather not have to talk to. But they got those hostages, and we want them back.
But the U.S. backs Israel's intention to eliminate Hamas.
We, of course, back their right responsibility to go after the Hamas threat, to eliminate that threat. Now, look, Jackie, I've said many times here, you're not going to eliminate an ideology through military operations. But does Israel have a right and a responsibility to eliminate a threat that they suffered on the 7th of October? 100%, absolutely they do. And we've been nothing but very steadfast on that.
Okay, this is very interesting because what he just said fits together with some, I thought, extraordinarily forceful and useful comments by the leader of the Israeli opposition, who is a very impressive guy. His name is Yair Lapid. He, for many years, was a very popular TV commentator in Israel, and he founded a centrist party to offer some kind of middle ground between the socialist, peace-oriented left and the more practical, tough-minded right wing, which of course is led by Prime Minister Netanyahu. And he was speaking in an interview with the New York Times Magazine. And the interviewer's name was Lulu Garcia Navarro. And she asked him about whether Israel's argument or position in the world took seriously the concern for civilian deaths that was expressed that is expressed all the time by the demonstrators here in the United States. And he said, I think they should learn the facts. I think they should understand that there is a reason why everything is happening. And the reason is Hamas. The reason is not Israel. I mean, not to be able to even track why what is happening is a total lack of even, I don't know, intellectual dignity or at least curiosity, he says. Listen, we are fighting for our life. And then the interviewer says, but there's another version of this story. And Yair Lapid, Israeli leader of the opposition, says, there is another version of this story, but it's not the right one. And I was involved, so I know. I want to tell you something else. I walked one day to a meeting with a very smart foreign minister. It was years ago. And she started the conversation by telling me, "We recognize Israel's right to defend itself." And I said, "Why are you saying this?" And she said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Is there any other country you tell that they have a right to defend themselves?" I wasn't angry with her. I was just curious about the question. Why is it that she felt the need to tell me that I'm entitled to defend myself and to defend my own country and not to die silently? You and I have succeeded, which is a great success, to go this far into our conversation without mentioning the possibility that maybe it is because we are Jews. And this is obviously very sensitive and important point to bring out on Holocaust Remembrance Day, which is observed around the world today and tomorrow. The idea that anti-Zionism really is anti-Semitism is brought up by this. Can you imagine anyone questioning or feeling necessary to assure the United States, well, after September 11th, you have a right to defend yourself? Of course you have a right to defend yourself. What if a country does not have the right to defend itself after a naked attack, a full invasion that murders people over 1,000 and takes 250 hostages, then why would anyone say, well, yes, we have, Israel has a right to defend itself, rather than simply acknowledging that this is a just war, because this is not a war to continue a cycle of violence or a cycle of killing. It is a war to end that cycle. And you only do that by destroying terrorists in their capacity. Breaking news from the Jerusalem Post. The Prime Minister's office in Jerusalem said tonight, because it's nighttime in Israel already, that the war cabinet had agreed to continue with Israel's planned Rafah operation. This comes despite Hamas's agreement earlier on Monday to the Qatari and Egyptian ceasefire proposal. The IDF spokesperson told the Jerusalem Post that the military was even now operating against Hamas terror targets in eastern Rafah. They had preceded this by a warning to civilians to basically get out of the way. We'll come back with the latest coming up on the Michael Medved Show.
More of Michael Medved in a moment.
Michael Medved Show, more news from Jerusalem. An IDF spokesperson said tonight, because it's already nighttime in Israel, of course, that the military has conducted precise targeted strikes against Hamas terror targets in eastern Rafah. The Prime Minister's office said earlier, just moments ago on Monday night, that the war cabinet had agreed to continue with Israel's planned Rafah operation. This comes despite Hamas's earlier agreement with a Qatari and Egyptian ceasefire proposal. We're joined by Michael Rubin, who is the director of policy analysis for the Middle East Forum. He is also a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he specializes in Iran, Turkey, and the broader Middle East. He's a former Pentagon official who has taught classes at sea about the Horn of Africa and Middle East conflicts, culture, and terrorism to deployed U.S. Navy and Marine units. Michael, it's always an honor to have you on the show. You're not surprised at all, are you, that the Prime Minister and the Israeli government failed to jump at this latest ceasefire proposal?
I'm not, because what appears to have happened, Michael, is that there was a bait and switch. Last week, President Biden and Netanyahu had spoken, and they had spoken again today, and Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State, said that the Israeli proposal was extremely generous. Now, initial reporting seemed to suggest that that was the proposal which Hamas had accepted. But when you actually look at the wording, Hamas simply said that they accept the proposal. And now it increasingly looks clear that what Hamas put forward was not what Israel had forwarded to the mediators. And so it seems to be sort of a propaganda play to delay the Israeli move into Rafah. And Hamas had made this gambit, saying that they accepted the ceasefire as Israel began ordering evacuations from portions of Rafah, which is really the last preliminary stage before a full-scale military assault.
Well, they have said that they have already completed some precise targeted strikes against Hamas terror targets. Does that mean going after some of the leadership of Hamas or some of the key terror tunnels? What are they talking about, do you suspect?
Well, it goes into the realm of what I suspect, because I don't know exactly what they targeted. But my answer to your question would be yes and yes. The most important targets for the Israelis would be certain tunnels and certain personalities among Hamas, command and control, leadership, bomb making, and so forth. But ultimately, they have been saying for some time they need to go in and really sweep the area clean, much like they did in other areas of the Gaza Strip. And Hamas, of course, doesn't want to do that, nor do they want to evacuate for two reasons. Number one, because they use the civilians as human shields. And number two, when they evacuated southward more than 6 months ago, they were going through UN checkpoints. Now the Israelis are in security control, and so any wanted terrorists would have to go through Israeli checkpoints. That's what they're afraid of.
5 minutes ago, the Times of Israel reported that the IDF troops are currently striking and operating against Hamas sites in a targeted manner in eastern Rafah. That means it's something less than a sweeping overall assault. It is going after some of those key targets you were talking about, Michael. I guess one of the biggest concerns that people would have is the Secretary of State and the spokesman for the president, John Kirby, and really the president himself have all emphasized how much they wanted to avoid an extension of this conflict to include Rafah, where there are many refugees from the north part of Gaza who are, quote, sheltering there. Do you think this is going to create some kind of open breach between the United States and Israel?
You know, it could. And what the Israelis are most afraid of is that the Biden administration, progressives in Congress would get so angry that they would withhold shipments of replenishing ammunition and that sort of thing. But at the same time, Biden's virtue signaling has a cost. When he does this, he basically blows wind into Hamas's sails and encourages them not to compromise because they think they can use Rafah as a safe haven. And that's what's been frustrating the Israelis so long. If you want to draw a corollary to when the United States was battling the Islamic State, we didn't allow the Islamic State a safe haven in Raqqa, its capital in Syria. So why should we expect the Israelis to do the same thing that we wouldn't find tactically acceptable?
I was speaking before to the audience, Michael Rubin, about the extraordinary interview with Yair Lapid, the leader of the Israeli opposition, who talked about speaking to a foreign minister at one point who said, "We recognize Israel's right to defend itself." And he found that extraordinary. Is there any other country in the world where someone would feel the need that we recognize your right to defend yourself? Is there any other country in the world that you would expect that country to submit to attack without self-defense?
No, and at the same time, there's no country in the world besides the United States and Israel where we are expected to feed our enemies during the actual siege. Meanwhile, what also hasn't been brought out, although the folks at the Foundation for Defense of Democracy uncovered this, is that the so-called Ministry of Health in Gaza, which is actually Hamas, can only name 10,000 victims of the more than 30 or 40,000 they say that have been killed, which again suggests that Israelis have been far more precise than perhaps the media wants to give them credit for.
And by the way, that's 10,000 victims, including a very high percentage of whom are Hamas combatants, warriors, right?
Well, I'd go further, Michael. You're absolutely right, and say that while the physical damage to the structures has been immense, and we've seen photographs of that, and that's because of the need to destroy the tunnels, I don't think that there has ever been an urban warfare campaign in world history that has been so precise and careful as what we have seen in Gaza. And those who have been crying wolf, those who have been saying the sky is falling, should have a lot to answer for when the smoke clears.
It's interesting. How do you think that the little cadres that are tenting in various universities across the country are going to respond to the most recent developments, the proferred, the supposed Hamas concessions and the Israeli determination to go after targeted operations toward toward the Hamas hierarchy?
Well, honestly, I think their reaction could be written by a 10-second code in a Google algorithm or something like that. They will blame Israel. They will self-flagellate. They will blame the United States and scream Viva la Revolution while wearing Che Guevara shirts. And of course, what's driving the Palestinians...
Don't forget the keffiyehs.
Exactly. And what's driving the Palestinians nuts is pretending you are in a hunger strike and that you need deliveries of bagels actually makes a mockery of what some Palestinians are going through. I mean, they have absolutely no sense of the real world around them. And again, people are being exposed for the frauds they are.
Michael Rubin, his most recent commentaries posted at our website at michaelmedved.com. There's a new statement about Hamas's latest truce offer. We'll get to that coming up on the Medved Show.
Here's a special discount, 50% off just for being a Medhead annual member. Join today at michaelmedved.com. More of Michael Medved in a moment.
On the Michael Medved Show, the Times of Israel reports most recently that the War Cabinet in Jerusalem has unanimously decided to push ahead with a targeted operation in Rafah, quote, in order to apply military pressure on Hamas with the goal of making progress on freeing the hostages and other war aims. That was what the Prime Minister's office said in a statement. The statement said that Hamas's latest truce offer is far from Israel's obligatory demands. For instance, in the Hamas truce offer, they offered to release only 30 hostages, and there are 130 hostages still being held. And the idea of simply trying to protect yourself by playing games with the hostages and trying to get a six-week ceasefire based on 30 hostages was not going to work. That's why I could say on the air, as I did earlier this hour with some confidence, that I thought that the celebrations about the potential ceasefire were way premature. It appears to be. Reuters is reporting that Israel played down the likelihood of a ceasefire in Gaza today after Hamas said it had accepted a proposal from mediators even as residents fled the city of Rafah in fear of an Israeli assault. The last-minute moves toward a ceasefire came as Israeli forces struck Rafah on Gaza's southern edge and ordered residents out of parts of the city for their own safety. Parts of the city had served as the last refuge for more than a million displaced Gazans. There was a piece in the Wall Street Journal, and it's an important piece and one with a novel point of view by Elliot Kaufman. And he makes the case that part of what has created this situation here was Biden's worst mistake in handling the Gaza war. He writes that when you hear that Gazans are trapped, you were encountering a Biden policy choice. It didn't have to be this way. Gaza's Rafah borders on Egypt, a U.S. ally that relies on $1.3 billion in U.S. aid every year. In contravention of international law, Egypt has sealed its border to Gazan refugees next door. Mr. Biden hasn't lifted a finger to stop it. On the contrary, the administration embraced Egypt's position early on and demanded that Israel not displace civilians into Egypt. No forcible displacement became Secretary of State Antony Blinken's absurd mantra as Gazans were massing at the border and begging, that's right, begging to be allowed out. Along with the United Nations and the NGO complex, Mr. Biden provided Egypt cover as it denied Gazans their human right to flee war. As the journal's editorial board noted, only when it can damage Israel does it become the liberal position to close the borders and keep refugees penned in a war zone. Elliot Kaufman writes, Mr. Biden never wanted a long war and is now desperate to end it and staunch the political bleeding, but his own policy error leaves him no good way out. Supporting an attack on Rafah would, at a political cost, endanger the civilians whom he allows Egypt to trap there, no matter how well Israel plans their evacuation. Opposing an attack, however, has prolonged the war, and imposing a ceasefire would, at greater political cost, ensure Hamas's victory. This is, again, a clip from yesterday. The Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, spoke about Holocaust Remembrance Day, relating it to events of this moment. Listen.
80 years ago, in the Holocaust, the Jewish people were totally defenseless against those who sought our destruction. No nation came to our aid. Today, we again confront enemies bent on our destruction. I say to the leaders of the world, no amount of pressure, no decision by any international forum will stop Israel from defending itself. As the Prime Minister of Israel, the one and only Jewish state, I pledge here today from Jerusalem on this Holocaust Remembrance Day. If Israel is forced to stand alone, Israel will stand alone. But we know we're not alone, because countless decent people around the world support our just cause. And I say to you, we will defeat our genocidal enemies. Never again is now.
That was Prime Minister Netanyahu observing what is called in Hebrew Yom HaZikaron, which means there's no mention of the Holocaust. It is simply Remembrance Day. But it is intended to remember and recall the Holocaust. And to go back just for a moment to the point that's made by Yair Lapid, who's on the other side politically in Israel. He is in the opposition, but he supports the conduct of the war. And the point that he was making was that the entire tendency to say, well, we support Israel's right to defend itself, you would never say that about another country. And when people talk about, is there a difference between anti-Zionism and anti-Israel sentiment and anti-Semitism, there really is no difference, because the essence of anti-Semitism is basically treating Jewish people different from any other people in the world. And saying that Israel has a right, or even questioning the right of Israel to defend itself, that is treating the one Jewish nation on earth as differently from any other nation would possibly be treated. President Trump told Republican donors at his Florida resort this weekend that President Joe Biden is running a Gestapo administration. The latest example of the president employing the language of Nazi Germany in his campaign rhetoric. This is from the Associated Press. The remarks Saturday at Mar-a-Lago were described by people who attended the event and spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss the private session. The Gestapo comment, one person said, came as Trump renewed his complaint that Biden's White House is behind the multiple criminal prosecutions of the presumptive GOP nominee, including his ongoing hush money and fraud trial in New York, and the additional cases stemming from his efforts to overturn the 2020 election. The Gestapo was the secret police force of the Third Reich that squelched political opposition generally and specifically targeted Jewish people for arrest during the Holocaust. Trump's unfounded comparison to Nazi-era tactics comes as he denies and tries to deflect from the charges against him, most notably his effort to overturn Biden's 2020 election victory before a mob of Trump supporters attacked the Capitol on January 6th, 2021. I am quite sure that no one commented to President Trump that it might be a little bit tasteless to pick Holocaust Remembrance Day as the day, or frankly any day, to compare the Biden administration to the Gestapo. The Gestapo didn't really provide you with defense attorneys. It didn't provide you with jury trials. It provided you with torture and death. That's basically the way they operated. And recognizing that evil in the world is profoundly important. It's also important, the progress of the campaign and a selection for vice president. We'll be getting to that with Rich Lauer.